This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Many in America have a shared memory. They can recall the exact details of when they saw a photograph in a 1955 issue of Jet magazine. It was the image of a mutilated body of 14-year-old Emmett Till. This is journalist Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes talking about his experience.
I mean, I remember seeing this picture in that Jet magazine when I was a kid. I think Emmett Till and I were probably about the same age in 1955, 14 years old. And growing up in Philadelphia, you knew vaguely about the South. But like others, my parents had protected me from the realities of the South. When I saw that picture and I said, hey, that's when I got my first lesson about the South.
That was a photo that changed the course of civil rights in America because there was so much behind that photograph, not just the image of the brutality, but everything that led to that. Emmett Till was a child who in his lifetime and his posthumous experience was inflicted with more injustice than anyone deserves. We're talking about Emmett Till this afternoon. We want to hear your stories. Do you have a memory of seeing that image? How does it impact you when you see it today? We can draw a direct line from Emmett Till in 1955 to Black Lives Matter today. What do you think about that? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Devery Anderson. He's the author of Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. He's going to be speaking tonight at the University of the Incarnate Word's Concert Hall, 7 p.m., free and open to the public. Devery, welcome to The Source. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Do you have a memory? I mean, you're too young to have seen the actual 55 Jet magazine when it was published, but when did you see that image? Did it have a resonating impact on you?
Yes, it had a major impact, and I saw it for the first time when I learned about the case in the fall of 1994. I was watching a video that I checked out of the library in Salt Lake City called Eyes on the Prize that featured a 15-minute segment about the Till case. And they showed those photos from Jet magazine, and immediately the impact upon me was immediate, and it's never waned since. And that's basically what led to me ended up writing a book on it several years later. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I was shocked that I hadn't heard of the case. For starters, I thought I knew something about Black history, but I discovered I didn't know as much as I thought I did, and that really changed my life. From the moment I saw it, I was depressed even afterwards, and I couldn't believe that something like this could happen. And as I learned over the course of that segment, just what happened and the result of this murder, the injustice involved, it just all had a major impact on me. And I had to learn as much as I began a quest immediately to learn as much as I could about this case.
What do we know about Emmett Till, Bobo, as he was called by his friends? What kind of individual was he?
Yes, he was from the south side of Chicago, born and raised in that area. I interviewed his cousins several times, those who knew him best. He interviewed his mother, too, before she died. They all describe him as a very fun-loving individual who liked to joke, who liked pranks, who liked to be the center of attention. And his cousin, Simeon Wright, who sadly just passed away this last week, he told me in an interview that Emmett was the kind of kid that would pull the fire alarm at school. And I asked him, I said, so he was that kind of kid or he actually did pull a fire alarm? And he said, well, from what I understand, he did pull a fire alarm. And to Emmett, it was just fun. He wasn't malicious. His other cousin, Wheeler Parker, to clarify a little bit, said, you know, he would do all this stuff, but it was just to have fun. And he was just a prankster, but he never meant to hurt anybody or would have hurt anybody. He had a soft side, a sensitive side that they saw as well.
14 years old, he just turned 14. He was a young 14.
Right. It was around a month.
So he's from Chicago, goes to Mississippi to visit family.
Right.
And he is there and what did he know about Mississippi when he went?
Well, he wouldn't have known much. He'd gone there a couple of times as a baby and a toddler, and I think he'd gone about 5 years prior to this last time in 1955, so he would have been about 9 years old. Always had family, like a mother or grandmother, with him. This time he was just there with his cousins. He had his great uncle, but he wasn't with them all the time, but he spent most of his time with his cousins. His mother warned him a little bit about how to act in Mississippi.
So he got the talk.
He got the talk. And so he would have known something about segregation, how black people are treated by white people just by custom, that you address white people as sir and ma'am, and it's yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. She told him that if he saw a white woman walking down the street, to not look at her, just to kind of move off the side, let her pass, don't say anything, don't look at her, because this is the kind of thing that could get you in big trouble.
And I guess that talk didn't take.
Right, and I don't think he really understood fully. And in the context of their evening on August 24th, it was a Wednesday evening, 1955, they were out, they'd been picking cotton during the day. It was a hot day, and so they wanted to go into town. They initially set out to go to a juke joint, but it wasn't open yet. There were only a few businesses and money at the time, maybe five or six along one street. The juke joint wasn't open. As they started to head home, they noticed a checkers game going on in front of the Bryant Grocery and Meat Market. And so they stopped there to take a look at this, what was happening on the checker board. And one by one, they decided to go in and buy some refreshments in the store. And it was a group of kids just having fun out in front of the store. A little bit of talk out in front of the store led Emmett to look at the woman inside the store. And that's really what started the events that led to this horrible tragedy. Emmett, after he had left the store, Carolyn Bryant followed him out, and he whistled at her. A wolf whistle, yeah. And, you know, he just saw that as something that, and we've all been 14-year-old boy. I've been a 14-year-old boy. And I know what it's like to flirt with girls and that. And I think he just saw her as just another teenage girl. He would have had no way of knowing she was even married, probably. I don't think anybody explained who she was. They just said, there's a pretty girl inside the store. You should look at her.
He was showboating for his cousins?
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, they would have been, you know, waiting for him to do something, you know, and looking through the window. One of them said that they were looking through the window to see what was going to happen. And again, getting all that attention, he was going in there for their benefit to do something. He was kind of a prankster, but he was fun loving about it.
So he's a 14-year-old child, just, you know, cutting up at a store, but this would cost him his life. He didn't know that at the time, but when the reaction from his cousins with the wolf whistle showed him that he had crossed the line. We're going to talk about that when we come back. We're going to talk about the last night that any of his family members saw Emmett Till alive and what happened to him. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. If you got questions or comments about Emmett Till, his death, and the launch of the civil rights movement, stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. We're joined by the author, Devery S. Anderson. He is speaking this evening at University of the Incarnate Word's Concert Hall, 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public, and you can go to their website at University of the Incarnate Word for more details. We were going through the narrative here of what happened. When we're going to break, we just left Emmett Till. He was at the meat market, and they had a whiff whistle confrontation with Carolyn Bryant, and they fled the store knowing that something had messed up. And days went by, 3 days went by, and nothing. But then what happened?
Well, on early Sunday morning, August 28th, it was around 2 in the morning, the family, the Wright family and Emmett and his cousins had spent the evening in Greenwood, just had come home about an hour earlier. They were in bed. Around 2 o'clock, pounding at the door, Moses Wright, it woke him up, and he asked who's there. And a man said, "This is Mr. Bryant. I want to talk to you and the boy." who did the talking, smart talking, but money. And so when Moses Wright opened the door, he noticed two men standing there in front. One was holding a flashlight in one hand and a pistol in the other hand. The other man there was identified himself as Roy Bryant once again. There was a third man behind them who was kind of hiding his face. Moses Wright never did figure out who that was. It was somebody he said he thought maybe was a black man, that maybe in time they've speculated that maybe he's the one who showed them where the showed Milam and Bryant where Emmett Till or where Moses Wright lived. Don't really know who that was for sure. But these men barged in, said they want the boy again, and they went from room to room, shining the lights in the faces of the six young boys who were there sleeping. And finally got to Emmett Till's room, and he, J.W. Milam asked, are you the one that did the smart talk? And Emmett said, yeah. And that angered Milam, and he said, you say yeah to me again, I'll blow your head off.
He wanted a yes, sir.
Exactly. And Emmett just acted nonchalant about the whole thing. He told him to get on and put on his shoes. And Emmett said, I don't wear shoes without socks. So he took time to put on his socks. Milam didn't want him to do that, but he did it. And they marched him outside. When they went outside, Moses Wright on the porch heard them ask somebody in the car, is this the right boy? And he heard a voice that he said sounded like it was lighter than a man's voice. It may have been a woman. And that voice said, yes, it is. And with that, they put Emmett in the car and drove off. It was so dark out, Moses said, that even though the car was parked, you know, I don't know, 50 feet away, he couldn't make out what kind of vehicle it was or anything. And so he didn't get to really see anybody out there. But he did hear that voice identify Emmett. They left, and that was the last they'd heard, that anybody heard of him, saw him alive. 3 days later, the body surfaced in the Tallahatchie River. It had been a young 17-year-old fisherman was out fishing, and he noticed a couple of knees sticking out of the water. He called his dad. His dad called the sheriff. Soon there was law enforcement there from Tallahatchie County, where the body was found, and LaFleur County, where Emmett Till was kidnapped from. They were all there at the river. Moses Wright was brought by two deputies to come to the river. Emmett's body was so badly beaten and damaged from 3 days in the river that he really couldn't identify him. But he said he thought it was him based on what he could tell. But the body, one of the hands on the body, one of the fingers was wearing a ring that they removed. Moses Wright took it home and showed it to his sons, and he asked them if they recognized this ring. Simeon and Robert both said, yes, that's Bobo's ring. He let us wear it. And so with that, they determined that the body was Emmett Till, and that set everything in motion for the next few days.
So initially, there was a missing case. They said Emmett Till is missing, and they spoke to those two men that went to the house, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, and they were saying they took him and they beat him, but then they let him go, right?
I should back up there. I got ahead of myself a little bit as far as the body. After the kidnapping on that Sunday morning, later that morning, the sheriff and deputy sheriff of LaFleur County went out to the Bryant store. Roy Bryant was in bed, but they got him up and said, there's this boy missing. Did you take him from Preacher Wright's house? Surprisingly, Roy said, yes, we did take him, but we let him go. He didn't say anything about beating him. They just said that they took him, showed him to his wife, and the wife and Carolyn Bryant said, no, this wasn't the right one. They claimed they took Emmett to the store, and that's where Carolyn identified him as not being the right one, and that they let him go. The store and Moses Wright's house were about 3 miles apart, and they said they just let him go and assumed he would find his way back. The next day, J.W. Milam turned himself in to police when he knew that they were looking for him. He told the same story to another deputy. And so they had rehearsed these stories, obviously, ahead of time, claiming that they took him and let him go. And it was after the body was discovered a couple days later that they stopped talking at that point. I think they thought when they put the body in the river, he would never be found. They could stick to the story of kidnapping and letting him go.
So he was weighed down with a cotton gin fan, which is a sizable metal object. tied to his neck with barbed wire, and he was thrown into the river. They thought that would be the end of Emmett Till, that they would, no one would ever find the body, and that they would be able to get away with this crime.
Exactly. And the fact that Roy Bryant was home in bed, he tells you where his conscience was. He was able to go home and go to sleep after that. And, you know, so many lynchings in the past. I mean, lynchings in the sense as they were practiced in the 20s and 30s, where you could have a lynching anytime and never had to worry about being prosecuted. In many cases, people were strung up or left or burned.
Or shot or in shot. The face in front of witnesses.
Exactly.
As and was what happened to someone just weeks before what happened to Emmett Till in Mississippi.
Right. There were two lynchings that occurred in May and August, mid-August. Emmett's was at the end of August. But the first two since 1951. And the reason we started seeing this emergence of lynchings once again was in the aftermath of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, where segregation and maintaining segregation was a hot topic. The gubernatorial race was heating up right then, and the various candidates for governor of Mississippi were all trying to out segregate each other, promising that I'll be the candidate who will maintain segregation. So in that climate, these other two men that were lynched, they were both active in black voter registration. And in that climate, blacks having the right to vote, they worried, you know, that segregation could get overturned and that. So they were determined to stop that. And so Emmett's timing to the Mississippi Delta was really, it couldn't have been any worse. With the race going on, all that was in the news, people were just worked up into a frenzy over segregation.
Right. So the Brown v. Board of Education, that decision came out in May 1954.
Yeah.
So it was just a year before.
Right.
After that, we saw, well, now we ruled that separate but not equal education is not adequate. We have to have integration.
Right.
And so, but there was a lot of resistance to that, and it wasn't really implemented into law just yet, but still there was a lot of activity from Southern politicians. We saw a lot of schools across the country being renamed for Robert E. Lee and things like that as acts of defiance to this decision, Supreme Court decision. And this is, that was just one thing that led. This is a progression of events. The Board of Education decision. We saw the murders of Lamar Smith, who was one of the activists, and Reverend George W. Lee, the other activist that you just mentioned,
right.
Both recruiting, trying to get African-Americans to register to vote. We had counties in Mississippi that were majority African-American, but they didn't have a single African-American voter.
Exactly. And the way they were able to do that, because constitutionally they had the right to vote. You couldn't discriminate based on race, but the way Mississippi and other southern states were able to discriminate was by coming up with these rules.
Like literacy tests.
Literacy tests was one, and the other was the poll tax to pay, and it was hard for a lot of black sharecroppers, which was the majority of the line of work that it kept them in a sense as in slavery, because you had a boss that ran the plantation, paid them, they would pay their sharecroppers very little or find a way to make sure that they always owed them money and kind of kept them on the plantation. It was very hard for them to pay the poll tax. And the literacy tests, the answers were always correct or incorrect based on the discretion of the registrar. So a white person could answer the question in the same way and they would pass.
There'd be questions like how many bubbles are in a bar of soap.
Right. It was ridiculous. And it was all aimed towards keeping blacks from voting. And they knew that. And it succeeded. You know, in Tallahatchie County, where Emmett Till's, where the murder trial took place, there wasn't one black registered voter. And it was like that in a lot of counties. And so, so we had that situation going on.
So we had an atmosphere of terror going on, where we had a population, African-American population, which were totally oppressed, and they were vulnerable to being victimized at any moment from a white person, and they had no hope of any sort of justice.
Right. No recourse at all if anything happened.
And in comes Emmett Till from Chicago, unaware of this atmosphere, and suddenly he steps out of line. He is then kidnapped, and we have these two individuals, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, saying, "We took him, but then we let him go," and then they find the body, and now we have a murder investigation.
Right. The body was discovered on the 31st of August. September 6th, a grand jury meets and indicts Milam and Bryant on murder.
How unusual was that, the indictment?
Oh, that was very unusual, because it was so rare that a trial would even take place in these cases. So a grand jury usually would be the ones to shut it down, where it wouldn't go anywhere after that.
So why did they get an indictment? What changed? Was it the attention?
I think the attention, you know, the prosecutor, the district attorney, was adamant that something be done about this. And initially, there was a lot of sympathy amongst the public for Emmett Till. If you see the earliest articles and editorials that appeared in the local press, people were outraged that these men did something like this.
Because by then, the photo of Emmett Till had been published in Jet Magazine. Mamie Till, his mother, had the open casket funeral in Chicago. Thousands of people turned up for that funeral to see that body, that damaged body, for themselves with their own eyes. This couldn't be contained. This couldn't be swept under the rug.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting, at that point, at the time it started getting that kind of attention, Mississippi felt the pressure at first they saw it as a local matter. Even though it got attention in Chicago, they expected that because he was from Chicago. And the attention in Mississippi was based on the fact that the crime happened there. They saw it as a local matter. They were sympathetic towards Emmett Till. As soon as the national press started in, then Mississippi came under scrutiny, which they don't like back then, because, you know, they were, any outside interference at all was not going to help matters. Almost immediately, the men, the shift in sympathy from Emmett Till to the killers began.
And right, so we're going to talk about that. There's tension building. There's all sorts of things are changing. This is a cusp of a new era in America, as we're talking about the murder of Emmett Till, the birth of the civil rights movement. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment, we want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about all these other events that were triggered by the murder, and then the acquittal, and then the confession of these two guys who profited from their story. This was sided with the Montgomery bus boycott with Rosa Parks. You know, the Kill a Mockingbird was inspired by Emmett Till. We still have to talk about other events that happened in Mississippi at the time, like James Meredith enrolling in Ole Miss and the riot that happened there, Medgar Evers and his assassination. All this led from Emmett Till and the civil rights movement. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Author Devery Anderson is speaking at the University of Incarnate Word's Concert Hall this evening at 7 o'clock. The event is free and open to the public. We have him with us this afternoon. He's the author of Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. Our phone lines are open if you want to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What memories do you have about learning about Emmett Till? Do you see a direct line between what happened to Emmett Till in 1955 and things like Black Lives Matter here today in the United States? Let's go to the phone lines with Lindsay. And Lindsay, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. This is kind of my first time on the radio.
So that's great. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to kind of have a correlation where clearly at the time, Emmett Till's or any young black man or black person, their lives were kind of, you know, not important. And still to this day, you can see that their lives are still not important. And although Emmett Till's life was ended 60 years ago, we're still having this battle to this day where black people have to, you know, fight and protest about making our lives and our voice voices heard. So kind of a comment and then a little question about the speaker for tonight. I didn't get your name, but do you think that this is still something that we have to worry about as far as Emmett Till and Black Lives Matter? Is there a correlation that you see?
Lindsay, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. So, Devery Anderson?
Yes, and I see that a lot, and I think about that a lot as well. I think Emmett's mother's decision to have this open casket funeral was really the first Black Lives Matter moment, because it made people uncomfortable. She received a lot of criticism for it, but yet it was a very brave thing, and she wasn't afraid of what people thought, and she knew it would have the impact that it ended up having. And so it was her way of saying, you know, this 14-year-old boy who people thought they could just kill, dump in the river, and that it would be forgotten about, that wasn't going to happen. And just that very fact that it didn't happen made Southerners uncomfortable. It made Northerners uncomfortable because it woke them up to what was happening in their own backyard in the South, as they saw the South, I think. And so that was a Black Lives Matter moment, and today we do see that. Now, we live in an era today where you see this happening with young Black men a lot, and it's waking us up, I think, but we're going through that uncomfortable stage right now where we're trying to find other reasons to cite that this isn't a systemic problem or something like that, and we need to wake up that it is. And I think by putting that kind of in our faces, the way Mamie Mobley did with her son's death back then, is putting us through that, and we see it. We see it so much that, and how many of these cases so far have their people, if they've been indicted, are found not guilty? We're so used to that now that we're uncomfortably used to seeing this play out in the way it does. We see it happen, we get outraged, and then nothing happens in the end. And so we're getting that message that Black lives don't matter, and at the same time we're trying to push that message out that they do. And so there's that tension, there's that conflict that's going on in society about that very thing. And you know, we need to wake up further, and we need to really see what the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to tell us. And it's not saying that other lives don't matter, it's saying that Black lives matter too. And the fact that we have to point that out in our society today, that the fact that we need that reminder, yeah, tells us why the organization and why the movement is so necessary. And so,
you know, when people say, you know, all lives matter, yeah, of course all lives matter, but there's a story of a guy goes to the doctor and he's got an appendicitis, it's about to burst, and so the doctor starts to, you know, puts his arm in a sling and says, well, doctor, it's my appendicitis. He says, yeah, but all parts of your body matter. You got to deal with the part that needs the most help. You got to do some triage. We got to figure out where we're going to put the help where it's got to go. And so, yeah, all lives matter, but where's the segment of the population that we got to address some issues?
And that's so important, you know, and we can look at the Declaration of Independence where it says in there that, you know, we're all created equal. And we can point to that and say, see, there's no problem. It says right here that we're all created equal. At the very same time that slavery was allowed in this country, and because that was put in there, we have this ideal. Slavery was allowed to exist in this country for another 90 years because you know, we could look at that and say all is well. Right. And if we say all lives matter, we can still look at that and we could point to a white person who's doing good and say all is well. Look, that person's doing fine. We have to point out where the issue is, where the problem is, and then we have to go in there and address it. As uncomfortable as it makes us sometimes, we have to do that.
Okay, we're talking about Emmett Till, the murder that shocked the world and propelled the civil rights movement. Another caller is here, Kathy. Kathy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for including me. I was in the South at that time and absolutely horrified by all this, and recognized that this was a Democrat thing rather than a Republican thing. And I'm thinking, how did things get so twisted since then? Now Republicans are accused of being racist. When all the way back from the Dred Scott decision, the Republicans voted against prejudice, and the Democrats voted for it. How did we get things so twisted now? Look at all the major decisions that have been made since then. It's always been Republicans that did the right thing.
Kathy, thank you for the call. So, yeah, the Democrats were in charge of the South at the time, and that changed when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. And is that the way you see it, Devery Anderson?
Yeah, and I guess I don't see it so much as party. It was, you know, it was the liberal segment of whichever party was in charge that was for this, for pushing for civil rights, the conservative ones that always fought against that. And once upon a time, the Democrats were more conservative, especially in the South.
Here in Texas?
And Republicans weren't. And so I don't look at it so much in party. I look at it so much more as ideology. It's the liberals, whatever party they're of, that seem to be, that always would push for civil rights, whether it was the, you know, overturning slavery or Jim Crow laws in the 60s or LGBTQ issues today. It seems to be the radicals that try to push things forward in that sense. And sometimes it's been different parties. The parties have been reversed, but it seems that the ideology of whichever party is the one that pushes that. So.
Okay, this is Hudit. Hudit, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I come at this as a mother of a black child, a black teenager who's 16. And just knowing like that this data is pervasive in every system, the systemic racism that, you know, minorities and specifically African Americans are affected disproportionately in education, in police, in the criminal justice system, in health, everything. Like, it's crazy to me.
All right, we're losing the call, Hudit, but thank you for the call. So any reaction to what you heard?
I didn't catch enough, really. We cut out so much that...
But there's a lot of racism still in society, and the African-American population is particularly there. We see them dealing with high unemployment still, even when we have a record low, you know, unemployment now, you know, below 5%, earning opportunities, high odds of being in a justice system. All sorts of problems are impacting the community.
Yeah, exactly. And the reasons behind that, you see so much debate about that. Is it still issues left over from the Jim Crow era where, you know, this perpetual poverty, you know, getting out of that and getting out of the way from the discrimination that allows for, you know, unemployment to continue? You know, what's the bottom line? What's causing the problem? That's what people debate about. But as a historian, I see so much that you really can still look back and see that our laws and changing laws and changing minds and changing hearts, you know, you can change the laws, the hearts come years later if they come at all, because people still debate this stuff. All this stuff really is related, in my view, to, for, you know, not only decades, you know, but centuries of discrimination and that's allowed racism to persist. And if racism persists, then we're going to see this divide, you know, with education, with issues with families, you know, breaking up, and issues with discrimination in the workforce. All of this, I think, can just be, you know, is the result of centuries of discrimination. And we've had 50 years of laws on the books, but hundreds of years prior to that of different laws that legally kept people down. And so, sadly, these things take time, but what we have to do is understand that it doesn't need to take time. If we adjust our thinking, and if we can wipe racism, minimize it, or wipe it out, which would be the ideal, we'll see all this other stuff change as well. And so... That's just where we're at, and the fact that we're debating it so much today with all the events in Charlottesville and all of this, whenever we open the door to discuss racism, it's such a polarizing thing that you can tell, and you can just see that we're nowhere near being on the same page or even able to get there to even discuss the root of the problem. And as long as that's the case, we're not going to solve it, I think, which is sad.
Some people say, you know, that just talking about racism perpetuates racism. Have you gotten any criticism about that with your book?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the number of times I've heard, you know, this is in the past, why bring it up? But the past is never past. I think Faulkner's the one who said that. And what's the result if we did stop talking about it? Would the problem just go away? No, it wouldn't. But yet we'd see so much stuff bubbling. We would reach a point where we would just see an eruption again. That's what happens when you sweep things under the rug. You know, people tried to sweep the Emmett Till case under the rug, and all it did was result in a new investigation because of all the people that refused to talk and stopped talking, it eventually came to a head just on its own. It just, that's a natural path that happens when something is tried to be swept under the rug. It doesn't stay there.
All right, another break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with author Devery Anderson about his book, Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. Our phone line is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Emmett Till's death and the civil rights movement. We're speaking with Devery Anderson, historian and author of Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. Got another caller. This is Bianca. Bianca, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I find it really hard to hear this story. I learned about it when I was in school and even in college, and then, of course, now. And it's really painful to hear, and it even enrages me, especially relating it to what we're going through today with police brutality of Black people and other minorities. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what more can we be doing compared to, you know, the outrage that people felt with what happened with Emmett Till and how they responded? Is there anything that maybe in your opinion that you think we could be doing that's similar to what was done for the Emmett Till case?
All right, Bianca, thank you for the call. Well, Emmett Till's case is still a cold case. No one was ever convicted of his murder. And so the justice for Emmett Till is still never actually achieved. But what it, I guess you could say, the justice of Emmett Till's murder came from the people that were inspired by what happened. I mean, what do you say to that, Devery Anderson?
Right, and his mother was determined that he not die in vain, and although no one was ever convicted, that he didn't die in vain. And because of that, because of everything that happened afterwards, you know, after the trial and these men were acquitted, a new level of outrage came out nationally and internationally, because we saw how brutal the murder was, and that was bad enough on its own. But the fact that the men were acquitted, people just said, enough. And so right away, protests erupted throughout the country and overseas. The only thing they had left, really, that they could hope for at that point was that there'd be some way of getting these men tried under federal charges. Because of double jeopardy laws, they couldn't be tried again in the same way, but possibly, you know, violating civil rights and that. But the civil rights statute at the time was very weak, and so nothing ever happened that way.
Well, President, they made an appeal to President Eisenhower. And J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI at the time, they did not respond.
Right. And so you know, they addressed it and just basically said, there's nothing we can do. It's a local matter. But if it can't be tried by the state again for the murder charges. There was hopes that maybe they could get them for kidnapping, but the grand jury didn't even indict them, which was odd because that's where they had the strongest evidence. They had a deputy and a sheriff testifying in court that, yes, we arrested these men. They admitted they kidnapped Emmett Till. And you have that coming from law, and the grand jury still didn't indict. So all of those injustices was, you know, resulted in these rallies where basically they wanted something to happen. Well, they wanted it to happen with the Emmett Till case, but there wasn't really anything that could be done. At least if you didn't have the cooperation of the federal government at that stage, nothing was going to happen. And they didn't have the cooperation of the Justice Department. So as a result of this, then grassroots movement sprung up, and the natural result of this was the Montgomery bus boycott. Just the Sunday before, Rosa Parks decided to keep her seat on the bus. Dr. T.R.M. Howard spoke in Montgomery. He was on a speaking tour. He spoke in Montgomery, Martin Luther King, at Martin Luther King's church. He tells about the Emmett Till story. Martin Luther King is there, an unknown, just local pastor at the time. Rosa Parks was in the audience. Then a few days later, this was like November 28th, and it was just a few days later that Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus. So in this context of international outrage over the verdict in the Till case emerges Rosa Parks and a determination to overturn segregation in the public transportation. So that long boycott as a result of this came out of the climate of the Emmett Till case. And that's really important for people to understand. So there was no justice for Emmett, but it spawned this movement that led to eventual laws that changed things. So in that sense, Emmett Till didn't die in vain. And that's the power of the Till case, really.
Another caller, this is Guylin. Guylin, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my phone call. I just got in the car and was very surprised to hear this on NPR. It's a beautiful story because it kind of shapes where I am today. I'm part of some of the marches and movements here in San Antonio. And some of the things that I've seen over time dealing with myself and looking at other people is when African-Americans or black people speak to police officers or speak to people in power, it's, why are you speaking to me this way? Why are you smart-mouthing me? Don't you have any home training? And it lends to back to when a man is in an elevator with a woman and says something, and a black man doesn't, or a young black man doesn't speak to that woman in the right way, and automatically there's something wrong with them. So I think that what we have today, if we don't learn our history, right, then we see where we are today. And one thing I want to end with, and I can't wait to hear what you all are going to say, but I'm 45 years old. I'm the first person born in my family with all of my civil rights. Voting rights of 1964 and then the Housing Act of 1968 finally gave African Americans all of their civil rights in America. And to think that at 45 years old, I'm the first person born with all my civil rights, but yet we're still talking about the Emmett Till case. We're still talking about police officers and others getting off for killing young black men and other people of color. And even in the trans community now, it's really sad that we continually have to go over these issues. And part of it is I feel that we're not learning our history, and we still haven't dealt with the real issues that we have in our country.
All right, Guylin, thank you for the call. I appreciate you calling in. I want to get another caller in really quick. This is Bill. And Bill, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for talking to me. My name is actually Phil.
Okay, Phil, I'm sorry about that.
Thanks for the discussion. And what seems to me to be missing here is the gorilla in the room every time the subject comes up. And I'm referring, if we could jump back in the discussion just a little, to Black Lives Matter, the concept of Black Lives Matter. I agree completely with everything that's been said so far, but it's what hasn't been said that disturbs me, and that's with regard to the amount of black-on-black violence in the community. All the figures I've seen run around 80% of the violence, the killings, are black-on-black, but yet no one ever seems to discuss that except for once in a while to throw the figures up there, and it's usually the cops that do it.
Okay, Bill, thank you for the call. So I want to get your reaction to that, Devery Anderson.
I'm not sure if those figures are correct. I think Donald Trump retweeted something with a figure that high a while back and was criticized for it. And I don't remember what the exact correct figures are. But I guess what I can say to that is I've been to meetings. I went to one with the Trayvon Martin family and the Till family a couple of years ago where they discussed black-on-black crime. And they saw it as a real problem. It wasn't something they were wanting to sweep under the rug or anything like that. They realized it's something that needs to be addressed. The reason that maybe it doesn't get as much attention as the others is because, people, I think it was Michael Eric Dyson that pointed out that people tend to kill where they live.
Right. No one's talking about white on white.
White people kill white people, because it's those types of disputes with neighbors or people in your community. And in poorer communities where people don't get out of the community, it's you're going to see that as well, black on black crime. So there's black on black, there's white on white. People kill where they live. And so, but it's, that doesn't mean it's not something that needs to be addressed. You need to address the issues in the community that lead to that type of thing.
That's where poverty
and everything else comes
to
in.
To bring that up, what does that have to do with anything? It's really not, that's not what we're talking about. It's not what's really propelling this forward. But let me go back to this important part of the developing story about Emmett Till. Carolyn Bryant, who is the woman that was the object of the wolf whistle at the store by Emmett Till, She has recanted part of her story. Some people see that as, there was no wolf whistle, but that's not exactly where we are with this. Can you kind of talk about that, Devery?
Right. The incident in the store, what we do know did happen is the stuff that witnesses talked about right away, and the accounts that wound up in the press. didn't come from the Bryants anyway. You know, Roy Bryant was arrested and Carolyn went into hiding. So right away, the people who were talking to the press were Emmett's cousins who were with him. They're adamant that Emmett did whistle at Carolyn Bryant intentionally, that he was just showing off as his personality, as we described, that's the kind of thing he would do. But what she said in court later was that Emmett tried to assault her, that he put his hand around her waist, propositioned her and said, "I've been with white women before," that type of thing. And she said this in court, and you can really trace how this story developed. It's clear that it, she didn't tell us from the beginning, her first and only interview that we know of.
These are inflammatory accusations.
Right. It was, at the time, if you were a black male, even a 14-year-old, if you were a black male, and there was anything inappropriate that happened between a black male and a white woman, it's going to be seen as almost as attempted rape regardless. But it's the one thing that a jury would never convict on, is if an accused black male, or if a black male is accused of being inappropriate sexually with a white woman. There wasn't a jury anywhere that in Mississippi that would have ever convicted a man in that case. And because of the initial sympathy and outpouring of sympathy towards Emmett Till in the first couple days after his body was found, the defense wanted to assure that they would receive an acquittal. And so the defense really came up with this idea that Emmett had gone in and sexually assaulted or attempted to sexually assault Carolyn Bryant or grabbed her inappropriately. You see the story evolve just from one of the defense attorneys who talked about it a couple of times. It came out in the press. The day before the trial started, he started telling reporters that, yes, Emmett Till went in there and he tussled her and he did this and that. And if he'd had any sense, he'd have taken the first train back to Chicago. He wanted to get that out in the papers so that any potential jury member would see that in case that testimony was banned from court. And it was banned in front of the jury. Carolyn Bryant told the story, but she didn't tell it in front of the jury. The thing is, the jury members already likely knew about it.
There's so much more to talk about. We don't have the time for this. This is a story that really needs an exhaustive telling. You can hear Devery Anderson speaking tonight at the University of the Incarnate Word Concert Hall, 7 p.m. It's free, open to the public. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great having you here. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.